The House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources for February 25th, 2003 is hereby convened. Welcome to all of you. And as I do, please take note of the registration witness sign-up sheet as it carries with it the language that we should all, if we are government officials and lobbyists, make note that by signing that sheet that we are acknowledging we will give truthful and accurate testimony in all cases. And if you hear from the general public, and I'm not sure anyone is, but I also say that doesn't apply to you, but we don't want you to not necessarily tell us truthful and accurate. So having said that, welcome to you all. We are not going to hear House Bill 2202 today. We are, however, going to open up a work session just work session on House Bill 2203. And we have with us Brendan McCarthy from Legislative Council, who's going to share with us what the Dash 2 amendments are all about and why we should consider those. Well, actually, we're going to tell us what they're all about. Welcome, Brendan.
Thank you, Chair Krupp, and members of the committee. Brendan McCarthy with Legislative Council. The Dash 2s came from a discussion that started before the Dash 1s, which relating to this bill, there was a general thought from the Department of Forestry, and I think it was a good thought, that if we are going to be talking about actions that they're involved in, we should give some guidance to people who are going to be in the future interpreting this bill as to who exactly, which actions it applies to. And I crafted the Dash 1s saying that this is going to apply to actions commenced on or after the effective date of the Act. And upon further discussion with the Department, I think, again, the Department was correct that perhaps that wasn't exactly specific enough, because under 477.068, the Section 1 in that bill, the Department makes a demand of the a demand letter first, asking for payment for what they spent in fighting the fire. And then, upon failure to comply with that demand, essentially, then can commence an action. There was thought on my part that perhaps the language that I had used in the Dash 1s may have encompassed the demand letter and may not have. So the Dash 2s are an attempt to catch all those people that, if I've got this correct, and Pete Norkovic can come up and correct me if I'm wrong, that the department may have issued a demand of, but has not yet actually started actual legal action other than the demand. So what we're trying to capture are all of those people, sort of, that there's an outstanding issue. So I've used all causes of action, whether arising before, on, or after, and then I've limited that all causes of action to only those actions that are not yet adjudged. So we're not going to be cracking open old actions from the word before. Anything that's settled, anything that has a judgment entered so far by any court is done. But if there is an action outstanding, a cause of action that has not yet begun, then this change would affect that action. That's clear.
Okay, would you go through the language of the amendment? And, Pete, would you come forward also, please? Brendan, go through the actual language and tell us what changes you made and what those language changes. I'm talking from the Dash 1 to the Dash 2 that clarifies exactly what you just explained to us.
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, thank you again. I don't have the Dash 1, so I just borrow from Pete's there.
Okay.
As I said, in the Dash 1s, I had drafted language that said it applies to actions to recover actual costs begun on or after the effective date of the Act. in the language in 477.068, the underlying statute that we are amending with Section 1, the department, again, can issue a demand letter for the costs. So in order to ensure that by this amendment, by the amendment to 477.068, we wanted to make sure that those amendments applied to people for whom the department has issued that demand letter. Because of the way the statute is structured, 477.068, there's the demand letter, and then there's language that says the department may commence an action after 90 days. So we wanted to make sure that all the actions that the department has sort of started by issuing that demand letter were indeed encompassed by this action, or by the dash twos. So we changed apply to actions to recover actual costs to apply to all causes of action, and then begun on or after to arising before on or after. And then the dash twos again, we limited those actions to ensure that those that were done, or in a sense, it may be on appeal, but those that have had some judgment entered would not be cracked open.
Okay, and that's what the subsection 2 of your amendment states.
Correct. And okay. What I'm trying to do here is ensure that we get those people for whom a demand letter has been issued, but maybe in that sort of 90-day period where an action has not yet started.
Okay. Pete, before we take any questions from the committee members, how does this fit in with what you're trying to achieve in this legislation?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Pete Norkovic, Department of Forestry. This was our best logical choice for how this is to apply. We look at this from beginning to end and what would be best in the interest of the intent of this legislation. And we have several actions that, in regard to our processes, are pending, have not been filed for suit, are in progress, and so forth. And the Dash 1 amendment would actually cause those to be excluded. And we just took this as a logical choice. We have several major cases that could benefit from this standard, and we felt that would be the best direction to take. It was a matter of pick one. This made sense to us. It makes sense to the cases. We have four or five cases that probably represent over $4 million in potential cost recoveries back to landowners. And as we had discussed before, the legal costs that get ballooned in these situations and the potential reductions because of confused juries over this issue, we felt it was our best choice to improve our chances on those recoveries. But again, this is not a hard decision for us or a hard position. I think we would just follow the wisdom of the committee as to which way you wanted to go, and we would apply it as such. We had to pick something, and this made sense to us.
Okay. Members, questions? Representative Gilman.
I'd like a list of all of those that you've sent demand letters to and a short summary of what occurred.
We could certainly provide that information to the committee and that understand that our cases overlap over sometimes many years because the cases are not yet resolved. We have mitigating circumstances. We administer about 200 or 300 cases a year, and we usually have about that similar number pending, both the small and large. But we certainly can get that information to you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Fripp. Can you give me an idea when you talk about confused juries, who you're talking about?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, what we're talking about is, and I think I reflected upon this in my previous testimony, is a lot of the cost issues or the effectiveness of the fire action are often resolved before we even get into the court system through our processes. Our oversight of our budget committees and so forth are putting us to the best standard we can be for performance out there. When we get into a fire action, we have a demand letter in a 180-day period of which we review additional information. There's opportunities to adjust and redirect or decide on the matter of the actual claim itself. What we're speaking of, what I'm referring to when I talk about jury confusion, is when we end up in ultimately in a trial because all the other options have not been successful. We usually have situations where the defendant has stipulated on negligence. They're responsible for the fire. They were negligent. But basically, they would like to have a reduction in those costs. And they go after issues regarding the effectiveness of the fire action. And we, reflecting on a couple of trials that we have had, we have spent several days just putting on testimony regarding the discretionary decisions during the fire action. And ultimately what happens is we're trying to explain to the jury the decisions that we made in a very compressed time frame under emergency conditions. And experts and consultants are brought in to testify, and they've had days or weeks to prepare and analyze our information, and they offer alternatives, choices that could have been made, but may not have necessarily been made based on resource availability or the time frame to make those decisions and so forth. And truly, the juries just get confused with that, and the jury isn't necessarily deciding the specific item of cost. They're just trying to decide in general terms whether or not the overall fire action was effective or not. And what that reflects in is a jury comes back with a decision as we feel this person's responsible, but we're going to cut the claim in half or we're only going to hold them accountable to 30%. They don't specifically adjust based on the evidence. They just adjust based on the emotion or their perception in the courtroom, and that's what I refer to as jury confusion, is they feel there's a real issue there. We really aren't arguing over specific cost details. It's whether who did the best job or was it the best job that could have been done? And the jury really, it's just an impression that the jury doesn't know what to do with that other than to just say, we'll reduce it. And whatever is reduced, again, is goes back on the burden of those other landowners that weren't culpable in the situation. So I that's the best, and it's a perception that they're confused with the general information, and they're not making a decision on specific cost items or it's not really a cost reconciliation process. It's just how they feel about the matter after they've heard testimony in the courtroom.
Thank you.
I just had one more thing to pick up on something that Pete said, which is that the intent of an amendment such as the Dash 2s is to really just make it clear. We could choose to have this affect virtually anything we want, so it's not a legal matter. We could set it forth in the future. We could set it forth in the past. We can set it forth in both. We can limit it to any actions we choose. And this was the language was done in conversation with the department as far as what would be best to capture at the moment.
Okay, but appreciate your perspective on that from the legal perspective. Pete, how soon can you get us the list of the demand letters that have been issued and kind of where you're at in the process of these issues?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilman, I would say that we could compile that very quickly. A clarification on that is that those that are just actually pending?
Yeah, it's the one. If we change from the Dash 1 to the Dash 2 amendments, I'd like to see how many people would be affected and the circumstance. So that's what I'm asking.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I believe we could compile that information in a few days, probably 2 or 3 days. That stuff is held in a database, and the part that take a little bit of time would be to put a description of the case, because we don't keep that in a database. It's in a case file, but we can compile that very quickly. We can get that to you.
So is it public record?
Yes, it is.
Some way I can go to a website or something like that and find it?
No, it ultimately is public record. But what we do is we don't publish this stuff because we're protecting the rights of potential litigants. And it's while we're in this process, to them it's a very private matter. And their insurance companies or attorneys may be involved and so forth. So there is a time frame under which we consider it a protected document for those parties to handle these things within those means. So we do not publish this, the case information, the clients, their issues, and so forth while they're active. However, the information is available but not published. We would have to respond to some requests and then compile the information.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Smith.
I would also like a copy of that list, too. If
actually, the chair would like to have you provide us with copies to all the members of the committee, if you would, please.
We would certainly do that.
And if you could do that by the end of the week, then we could potentially have this bill up for discussion again next week.
Certainly.
Right. Any further questions, members? Thank you both very much. Appreciate it. The chair would like to ask, even though we're not in public hearing, we have received some additional letters, and have all members seen these, Ray? Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Smith.
I would request that we have another public hearing.
I think clearly we need to. We're hearing a lot from, I don't know about you all, but I certainly have heard from a fair number of folks, and I know Representative Gilman has, that have sufficient concerns. I would like to ask a couple of individuals to come forward to sort of share their thoughts with us at this time. Jim Geisinger and Glenn Stonebrink, if you'd both come forward. Welcome, Jim. You have written a letter to me in regards to this particular bill, and so I'd like to have you share with the committee what your concerns are.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've also shared that letter with other members of the committee as well.
For the record, state.
My name is Jim Geisinger. I'm Executive Vice President of Associated Oregon Loggers. This isn't the first time that this measure has been before the legislature. It seems to be a perennial attempt by the department to make itself immune from litigation and the right that people have to question judgment calls that they make. Last Wednesday, Senator Farioli in this very room had an informational hearing on the 2002 fire season, documenting a lot of the excesses and problems that occurred with suppressing fires in 2002 and itemizing a list of things that need to be corrected to make our firefighting force more efficient. Now, I will be the first to say that the Oregon Department of Forestry stands head and shoulders above any other agency that's involved in firefighting that I'm aware of. They do a very good job, but that does not make them immune from making bad judgments or poor discretionary decisions that citizens ought to have a right to question if they're going to be asked to pay the bill for those decisions. That just seems to be common sense. It strikes me as being a little bit beyond reason to suggest that a government agency should be immune from making decisions that are going to have a personal cost for individuals or for companies. And I appreciate their desire to make themselves protected from those kind of liabilities, but this is the United States. I thought we had a democratic society here, and for a citizen to not be able to question a discretionary decision by a government agency doesn't seem to be consistent with those principles, and that pretty much summarizes our concerns. You know, theoretically, the state could call out the National Guard and have a fleet of air tankers dropping retardant on a one-acre fire. And under this bill, they would have no recourse but to pay the costs for those excessive suppression activities. I know that that's an extreme analogy, but the point is it could happen.
Okay, Jim, thank you. Members, any questions of Jim at this time? Glenn, your concerns, please.
For the record, Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I would like to ask the committee to defeat this bill based upon several things that Jim Schlesinger has just spoken to. The Oregon Cattlemen's Association represents an awful lot of ranchers in this state, and I will tell you, unfortunately, we are very familiar with the courts. We're in the courts all the time just to try to protect our livelihood. And we're always asked for the burden of proof, to prove our side of the case. There's all kinds of discretionary, subjective opinions from the other side, and we're there continually. Well, this bill would not allow an individual landowner in case of a fire on their property, and somebody in the very beginning of the bill, it's actually not in language, but on page 6 it says that if an owner, landowner, is willful, malicious, or negligent in the origin or subsequent spread of fire. Well, that in itself is very subjective, and there should be some kind of a burden of proof to say that, you did this willfully or you did this negligently. In summary, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just think this bill usurps the due process of law for private landowners.
Question to you both. I have some limited experience fighting brush fires and no actual forest fires, but in the urban interface, and a lot of years as a farmer field burning fields and fighting wildfires and so forth. And sometimes, just depending on the circumstances, you have to make certain decisions on the spot, and it's difficult to always make the correct one. People are certainly fallible in those decisions. And part of the dilemma that I have seen with my own eyes as a firefighter is that it is difficult to always make the right decision and then have people come back and second guess you coming down the road. And we have some laws in place. When I, as a firefighter, go out on a car wreck, I'm immune from lawsuit because I'm acting in a certain capacity. If you, as individuals, come upon a car wreck, and it's called the Good Samaritan Laws, and you offer aid and assistance, and then something you did has been viewed as incorrect, you can't be sued by that later on. Those are generally thought of to be for the greater good of the public. How is this any different than that, in your mind?
Well, I think in everyday life, certainly in business, people make decisions every day that they may think are very well-intentioned and the right thing to do, only to find out later that they may have violated a law or not made as exercise as good a judgment as they thought they had. That's the nature of the system. And I appreciate the kinds of decisions and snap judgments that these folks in the field have to make. But under this law, as I understand it, these are for fires where negligence has already been determined on the part of the operator or the landowner. So there's no question that the fire was their responsibility. The question is whether or not the actions that were taken to suppress it were more than necessary to extinguish that fire. And I think that's a legitimate question that people ought to be able to raise. Challenging accounting procedures, why would anyone even go to court if the bill was going to be the same no matter how they accounted for it? I mean, that's a frivolous procedure in my view. I think the difference is that this is individuals' rights to question a decision by a state agency. So I guess that's the best answer I can give you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Glenn.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. I reflect back on my younger days. I spent a lot of years as a volunteer fireman in a little town called Yamhill. Even spent a number of years as fire chief when no one else wanted to take their turn in the barrel. We went to a lot of fires that were set by landowners. We didn't get paid. It was strictly voluntary. Civic duty type thing. We made decisions on the spot that sometimes people even wanted to come sue us. Luckily, we didn't get sued, but we got a lot of blame. Sometimes we didn't do everything just right. But really what we're talking about here is not the decision on whether a fire department or the Department of Forestry would go onto private land and put the fire out. That's really not what we're talking about. We're talking about the cost that are occurred in this process and then going back to the landowner and say, now pay for this cost because we made a decision, and then we're saying, but if this bill passes, you can't challenge our decision. And so it's only talking about the cost. I say it isn't the decision. It isn't the decision unless there's cost occurred and there's a cost trying to be recouped. It's when that kicks in, then the landowner has no opportunity to challenge the original decision to start with. It's just like, I am God, I'm coming on that property, and I'm going to put that fire out. And we've had situations with one of our members a few years ago where he was burning some grass on his place, and the local fire department came out, was not in their protected district, but they decided to put the fire out. And he said, well, I didn't want you to, but you did it. Then he got a bill for it, and he, you know, eventually ended up in court, and that sort of thing, was actually thrown in jail for it. But, so it was discretionary, but it was the cost that kicked in, not the fact that they put it fire.
Okay. Quick question to either one of you. Is there any, you see any compromise on this issue? Is there any way to try to achieve the goals of what is fair and reasonable in the concept that the agency's brought forward?
Mr. Chairman, I can't see anything reasonable about what I heard here earlier, that maybe the juries would get confused, maybe the defendants, in this case the landowners, would have too much time to prepare for their case. I don't know how you compromise that. If there were, I would love to be able to take some of those to court myself, but I don't know how you, I mean, that's the sole purpose of this bill. It's black and white. You either take away their rights or you don't take away their rights. I don't know how you compromise that, Mr. Chairman.
I think if we're going to outlaw confused juries, our whole court system is going to collapse around us.
Point well taken. Representative Smith and then Representative Hunt.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Chair Crump. Do you know any other state agency that has this authority?
Chairman Krupp, Representative Smith, I personally do not know.
Neither would I.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hunt?
Hey, really following up on Chair Krupp's question, it appears that we all lose when we start spending dollars on court costs. I mean, both sides are spending dollars on court costs, spending dollars on attorneys, no offense to any in the room. But, I mean, is there a way, not necessarily in terms of trying to change the legal process, but do you see any compromise in trying to set up some kind of other process that would begin to arrive at what you would gauge to be fair decisions, but trying to do that before it gets to a legal process where all kinds of dollars are spent, none of which goes for firefighting?
Well, Chairman Krupp, Representative Hunt, I suppose there could be a procedure that you could go through before you go to court, such as an appeals system where you challenge those decisions and the costs associated with them before a tribunal that's other than a court. I mean, you could take it to the Board of Forestry. You could create a special commission of expert firefighters to review those decisions. But ultimately, if either party disagrees with the outcome, outcome of that process, they're going to end up in court anyway, unless you specifically precluded that subsequent action. So to me, this is about as an efficient system as you're going to have if you choose to give landowners and loggers, and in our case, the right to challenge those sorts of decisions.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt, I guess in reading the bill, there may be a step in there that when the letter is sent to the landowner to pay this amount, if the landowner had a step where they could challenge these costs or even challenge the decision to come on and say, I disagree with this, at least a review process, that would at least tell, in this case, we're talking about the Department of Forestry, at least tell them that that this landowner doesn't probably plan to pay the amount, for one thing, and then perhaps they could negotiate at that point before they get, maybe the letter would give them some hint that the costs were twice as much as they should have been. Well, okay, maybe you can cut it in half and save going to court. A little bit about what Jim's saying, an administrative hearing, but that's still going to be done by the Department of Forestry, I'm sure. But this also reflects on any fire district, really.
Okay. Any further questions, members? Representative Fire.
I just have a question. I realize we're in work session, and do you anticipate bringing this back again for a public hearing process?
I think that may be necessary, depending on how the public continues to come forward with thoughts and concerns over the legislation. I think we ought to, as chairman of this committee, vet this issue to its fullest extent.
Yeah. Well, just to follow up, thank you.
Sure.
It's just that, a few little questions have popped up in my mind, and I don't think this is probably the right venue to ask them or look at them. So.
I appreciate that, Representative Byer. I think that's a point well taken, that we ought to explore this a little further so that all the members of this committee are comfortable that your questions have been answered to the fullest extent on this issue. I think that's very fair. Thank you, gentlemen, both very much. And with that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2203. And we're going to open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2634. Ray, just want to briefly describe for us what this bill is.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2634 provides that road graders used in agriculture are exempt from registration. ORS 803.305 establishes exemptions from vehicle registration requirements under Oregon's Vehicle Code. Current law exempts, among other equipment, farm tractors and farm trailers on highways when the operation of the vehicle is incidental to its agricultural use. This measure adds road graders to this farm exemption, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ray. Members, you'll notice that on the printed bill, I think my name appears there somewhere. At the top, let me share with you why I brought this particular issue forward. This was a constituent of mine, a longtime friend who is a farmer, who uses a road grader for the purposes of creating ditches in his ryegrass fields out in the flatland of the valley. And driving from one field to the other, he was ticketed by a member of Linn County's Finest, which asserted that under the law, that road grader has to be licensed and registered. And so he asked me to bring forward this issue to simply bring road graders that are used for agricultural purposes only into the same category as tractors and combines and windrowers and hay balers are, and any other farm equipment today. And that's basically what you see is a bill that on line 29 adds two words to the statute, road graders.
And I have for you and would like to enter into the record and have Ray make copies of three letters from three different farmers, who, including the farmer who was ticketed, who supports this idea. And that's why we're considering the legislation today. So as Ray makes copies of that, I will call forward Gene Wilkinson from the Oregon Farm Bureau. Welcome, Gene, and for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Gene Underhill Wilkinson, Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I apologize for not having written testimony today. I know Representative Nelson specifically likes that it was a last-minute decision to come up here and support this bill, but it is something that I recognize as a good bill that's needed for the farming industry. I just wanted to validate some of the points that Representative Krupp has just made. I am aware in the farming industry that road graders are a very common piece of equipment used in farming practices along with the other farming equipment. Many times in the country where I come from on highly erodible hillside farming, the roads that lead into the fields, the private roads, or I should say the dirt pathways that lead into the fields, wash out very commonly and need to be regraded every year. And so it's very common for the farmers to own those road graders and only use them, only take them out on the public roads for the purpose of getting them from one field to the other. I would think that they would be recognized by the road authorities as being pieces of farm equipment, but apparently it needs to be specifically addressed in statute, and that's something we support when they're used incidental to a farm operation. So, again, we support House Bill 2634. Thank you.
Gene, a couple of questions come to my mind, and perhaps you can share with us generally what the direction might be. If it's not registered and and on the road and licensed, would it be necessary to have SMV signs on them?
Representative Krupp, members of the committee, you might want to ask a representative from the Department of Transportation if you want some clarification on that, but I would think if it's considered to be implements of husbandry or farm machinery, then it might need to follow those, or it would be appropriate to follow those same rules, which includes a slow-moving vehicle sign.
Okay. And the next question I would have, it isn't likely that a farmer is going to go take his road grader out on the county road and grade the county road, is it?
I believe that's illegal, so I doubt that that would be taking place. The only reason why it should be taken out on the road is just to move it from one field to the other, just as you do other farm machinery.
Okay. Members, any questions? Gene? Yes. We'll start with Representative Byron and Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Not being a farmer or having much connection to farms, how is this a pretty standard equipment for a farm?
Mm-hmm. Chair Krupp, Representative Beyer, I believe that my knowledge of agriculture, and I come from an agriculture background, is that these road graders is very common for farmers to own road graders because they're used on the farm operations so frequently. Or you have to have road graders contracted, which can be very expensive. So many farmers just go out and purchase their own road graders as part of their other types of farm machinery.
Yes.
So at this point in time, when these farms have these, do they license them?
Representative Krupp, Representative Beyer, as far as I know, they consider them to be pieces of farm machinery, and as farm machinery is not required to be registered and follows its own specific statutory requirements, they consider the road graders to be an implement of that farm machinery. So they don't have them registered or licensed.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Chair Krupp. I guess I'm more concerned about your question than I am Gene's answer. Danger of going to jail for the rest of my life.
Well, then don't say it. I'm just kidding.
Okay. For protection of Patty, prevent her from going to jail. No, I thought that I could use my road grader to grade my road because that's fire protection and I'm protected by it. And that is allowable with my road grader at the farm. I mean, I understood that that is a use of
Representative, are you talking about on public roadways or on private roadways?
Well, in Yamhill County, I'm not sure there's any difference because they're all bad. I don't know that answer. hedge a little bit, Mr. Chair. The problem is as you turn off of a whatever, I don't know who owns this road, the main road, which is not maintained. I mean, if you didn't maintain it as a farmer out there, I mean, you couldn't get any protection against fires. I mean, nobody could get out there. So all the farmers, I mean, this is one of the reasons they essentially need these. You know, not only the roads on their own to get around their crops and fields and their equipment, but after we've had marsh and rain and you've got to smooth out the ruts substantially so you can move your equipment, even logging equipment for that matter, in. But it was my understanding that we are protected because you do have the right to fire prevention and protection.
Good question, and since we have some experts from the Oregon Department of Transportation in the back of the audience, Doug, would you come forward, please? And Gene, do we have any further questions of Gene, members?
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gene. Doug, welcome. Sorry to drag you into this, but Representative Nelson actually brings forward pretty good questions.
Well, I'll try and answer it. Chair Krupp, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Doug Tindall, State Maintenance Engineer with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Representative Nelson, I'm not sure that you're violating a law necessarily if you graded a publicly owned road with your equipment, but you would be incurring a liability if you did that without permission of the road authority, because then anything that happened as a result of your activity on the roadway could come back to you personally. But I do not know that it is specifically illegal to do.
Oh, good. Okay. You make me feel much better.
Thanks, Doug. Members, since we have no further witnesses, is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? And hearing none, we'll close a public hearing on House Bill 2634, and I don't anticipate necessarily any amendments coming forward. I think we'll go ahead and wait a moment and see if anything else pops its head up in regards to this concept before we schedule it for a work session down the road. With that, members, it looks like our business is concluded for the day. We are adjourned. Thank you all.
I'm going to go home and find out who owns this game.